Anatomy of a Worldview, Part 3, the third talk in a series on foundations of knowing the truth, was presented by R. Wesley Hurd on October 15, 1991, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Hurd's answers will be sufficient to understand the context. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
I guess would be the right way to put it, or restating the fact that in some ways the world, the concept of a worldview as I've been treating it, trying to give kind of a basic grid for understanding what it is a very simple concept, one that you can get a hold of very quickly. And in that sense, it could be taught very quickly. But it's a very profound, I think, a very profound and helpful concept. I wish that I had had a better, I wish I'd had any kind of a grip of what a worldview was when I was going through my undergraduate studies. It was incredibly helpful to have it in my later graduate studies going through university here, because there literally was not a give any session that I didn't sit through, whether it be a lecture or a book discussion or a private one-on-one with a professor, a reading course or a seminar with other graduate students. There was never a session where my understanding of my own worldview as best I have put that together, as well as I've put that together, and my understanding of the other dominant worldviews that were being promoted in the classroom, there was never a session when those things weren't clearly helpful in trying to come to terms with what I thought about what was going on, trying to make judgments. I remembered very distinctly a session where I was taking a course in historiography, the study of history, what is history, what goes into making or writing history. And there were 25 other grad students in this class, in this seminar. And the whole momentum of the seminar was starting to drift in this particular direction, and I could just feel the weight going. The question was revolving around the issue of whether history is something that objectively happened, or whether history is something is simply a construct, subjectively, in a sense, relativistically placed at a particular point in time, only to be replaced or supplanted with another theory a few years down the road. And boy, the class was going, they were headed down the road. You know, they were all of the mind that if the tree fell in the forest and nobody heard it, it didn't fall in the forest. And I don't know, this was really, it was obviously revealing a very powerful, dominating belief in most of the worldviews of the people in the class. And I got to this place and I thought, no, wait a minute. I said, but we don't treat history like that all the time. I mean, there's sort of theoretical history, history that is beyond us and not recoverable, by which we go back and we do data gathering and try to recover information that will help us write what we think happened as best we can figure that out. Or if we already think we know what happened, go back and prove what I think happened, depending on how I handle the evidence. But there's another kind of history. It's a more mundane, everyday kind of thing. A child molestation and rape case. And we don't treat that history, whether it happened 2 weeks ago, 2 months ago, 6 months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago. We don't treat that kind of thing as if it was history that didn't happen or was simply the construct of somebody's imagination. If there's some kind of damage and harm, maybe even death, that has been caused, we treat it pretty seriously. In a very commonsensical kind of way, we go to court, we go back and we try to find the evidence, and of course there's subjectivity involved in the testimonials of people who were involved or were in some way witness to this event or knew something about the character of those who were involved in it. But we don't treat it as if it's just something we can re-manipulate and put a new theory out. And the whole class just kind of came to this abrupt stop, and that the professor kind of said, well, yeah, maybe you've got a point there, and just they were off on another winging it again. Anyway, all that is simply to say that in my experience, an understanding of how worldviews work, what their basic componentry is, and even taking something as simple as James Sire's 5 or 6 questions that a worldview will try to answer is very, very helpful. In fact, tonight what I'd like to do is take us on a little excursion here. I've handed out some things that I want to run over very quickly, and then we'll have just a kind of a discussion and critique session. Let's look at this one first. It's just what I call the worldview market at the top. This is just my little attempt to take the various worldviews that James Sire suggests in his book as a good sort of general grid to work off of in establishing where the dominant worldviews today are, what they're like, sort of in a very simple description, and maybe even tracing it historically. I might mention that book again, The Universe Next Door by James Sire, he argues from my little chart here, from the left to the right, you'll notice I've listed Christian, deist, naturalist, nihilist, existentialist, Eastern religions of the pantheist, monist variety, and the last one is New Consciousness or New Age. In his book, I think he does a terrific job of not only describing and giving you a good kind of working map of the major characteristics of each of these worldviews, or basic worldviews, but he also shows the logic between them. And he traces, in a sense, the development from the Christian worldview, which was in place for over 1,000 years in Western culture and out of which came Western civilization and modernity and certainly our societies and culture. From that, he suggests that there was a deviation into deism and sort of a little island between two major worldviews that now are two of the major worldviews, I think, in the world today, Christianity or Judeo-Christian biblical worldview and the worldview of a naturalist or the secularist or the humanist. And then he suggests that nihilism is simply the response, the normal logical kind of response to the consequences of looking at naturalism objectively. Naturalism or humanism has some serious weaknesses in it with regard to being human, with regard to determining the basis of morals and ethics. And he suggests that when someone, and even the substantiation and maintenance of something like science, ultimately collapses in naturalism. We don't have time to argue that here. He looks at that very carefully in the book, or at least some. Nihilism is that place of hopelessness. It's more of an attitude and a pervading sense of a brooding attitude and posture toward life rather than a well thought through.
If you say God is dead, would the nihilist say that there really was at one time a God then? The implication that if he is dead, at one time he was alive.
Well, most people think, certainly starting with Nietzsche, who coined the term God is dead, What those people mean is that we killed God. God was a construct, and we lived under it for a long time, but we killed him. We went to his, we created his funeral. Same thing with the God is dead theologians in the 50s. They basically came to the place where, sort of at the extreme end of liberal theology, where taking the dictates of, taking the assumptions produced by modern philosophy, namely positivism and then analytic philosophy, which is about where we are today. It ends all conversation between meaningful conversations about meaning. Meaning is gone, personhood is gone, and I can't remember just off the top right now exactly what the God is dead theologians did with all that, but basically they were lining up behind the thrust and impetus given by the secular philosophers. And they were basically trying to, in a sense, construct a theology out of atheism.
Did the Wittgenstein use God?
They fit in that groove, yeah. I'm not sure exactly how, but they're there. Existentialism is a worldview that tries to come to grips with nihilism. It tries to take nihilism seriously, but then to move beyond it by admitting that, yes, there is no God, there is no design to the universe, there is no, this is all here by chance, this is an absurd universe, there is no way of constructing meaning, except, and this is where the existentialist comes in, existentialist goes back and rewires the whole philosophic endeavor or enterprise by saying, no, we've got to rethink this whole thing here. Everything is absurd, but the one thing that I can say is true from my experience, says the existentialist, is that I am here, and that my existence precedes my identity and my meaning. That is, if there is no creator God, then I'm a cosmic, I am a product of a series of cosmic accidents, succeeding accidents. And so here I am, but here I am. I'm not nothing. I'm here. I am a consciousness. I am a being. And so far as I can tell from the phenomena of my experience, I can choose. I can choose. And that lies at the root of my meaning, my life. There are lots of things I can't control, but I can choose. And that kernel is the power that gives meaning to my life. Meaning is choice, so choose. And so the whole existentialist philosophy is admitting the absurdities of a chance universe and then trying to construct something out of that based on the fact that we can radically, we smash into the radical realities of our absurdity, our meninglessness, and we rebound from that, as Nietzsche and Sartre and others said, making ourselves God. We have to be God for ourselves. We play the role of God, in other words, determining what is true for us.
How does that differ? I always get in my mind like the humanist or the naturalist.
Those are actually, they can be very synonymous. I mean, they can be the same. A secular existentialist would be a naturalist. There are religious existentialists who, at the point of the choice, at the point of the crux of the impact of not knowing, there is an assertion that God is there. There is a radical choice that God is there. I choose in the face of absurdity that God is there, and whatever my concept of God is and whatever my concept of how God interacts with human beings comes in at that point. For example, Soren Kierkegaard is considered by many to be the father of existentialism altogether. And he was certainly a Christian who was reacting in his time to the pompous certainty held by the naturalists who were pounding that science and man and evolution was going to lift us all to new heights of utopia. And the church was involved in that, and he was a critic, very fascinating critic of all that. Okay, then the last two, Eastern religions, pantheism, and then the most recent and rising powerful worldview in the West is what he refers to, or I've charted here, as New Consciousness or the New Age beliefs. We don't have time, you can well imagine in the brief time that we have tonight, to go through and look at this with any detail, but let's just go back through these very quickly. Yes?
In his rewriting, doesn't he include communism?
Does he? Yeah, I know he did an edited version.
I haven't read the re-edited section.
Yeah, Marxism.
I think he, maybe it's Marxism. He added that to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that would be a subset of naturalism. Okay. I mean, I think that it's a highly ideological / political worldview, whereas these are not necessarily aligned with any particular political agenda, but be that as it may, I mean, there were, and maybe still are, a few hardcore Marxists floating around.
Well, in the rewrite, he didn't even write that section. He decided he wasn't qualified enough to write the Marxist section, so he had somebody else write that.
Good. Thanks for pointing that out. Okay, the Christian worldview, all I've done in this little chart is try to indicate that where on my expanded worldview grid that I gave you last week and the little chart that I gave you, the in the box that I've called presuppositions, assumptions, and beliefs, that's the box where my pre-understandings, as I mentioned last week, and my derived presuppositions or my basic worldview grid fits. And then I've simply included the mechanism of intelligence, that is, antithetical thought, rational thinking, the very mechanics of being able to think as a part of that picture, just recognizing it as such. Okay, in the Christian worldview, as you remember, the seven questions that, room to write them on the board, but the seven questions were, first one is divided into two parts. What is reality? Cyrus says, puts the question, what is prime reality, what is secondary reality? And then he asks the question, what is or who is man, what is mankind? What does it mean to be human? And then he asks, what is the basis of morality? What is the basis of ethics? Upon what foundation do we build a theory of ethics? Then he asks, what is death? What is the meaning of death? Is there meaning to death? Is it of any significance? What is that significance? And then he asks, what is history? Is history full of meaning? Is it going somewhere? Is it linear? Is it running in circles? Is it cyclical? And then, how do we know? How do we know? On the basis of what do we establish our theory of knowledge? Or how do we know with certainty? Or how do we know at all? And how would we argue that we know? In each of these boxes, I've touched on at least two or three of the main questions in the worldview that he asks. In the Christian worldview, God is prime reality. The universe is his creation. Mankind is made in his image as a person, was intended to share in the glory of God, share in his righteousness. History, yes, history is linear. It's going somewhere. It has a beginning. It will have an end. It's going through ages. And ethics are based on the character of God, based on God himself. In the deist worldview, which is a fascinating little period of time, most people don't really fancy themselves as deists today, although in some respects you might find someone who'd say, well, I believe there's a God there, but I don't think God has anything to do with us. The whole idea is, as you may recall from high school history or whenever you looked at some of this stuff, the deists like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and many of those who were around at the time of the founding of this nation and who were very much involved in it were of a deist stripe, so to speak. They didn't conceive of God as personal. They conceived of God as being impersonal, more like a force, a reality, not a personal God as presented in the Bible. Salvation was not an issue because sin was not an issue. Creation was, the universe was created as a perfect clockwork. God is sort of just the great force that created it all, wound it up like a big clock, and set it free to run on its own. And God is not involved in this creation anymore, i.e., we don't really believe that miracles happen. Everything is a product of what we perceive to be natural, normal laws of cause and effect. Man is not a sinner. He is perfectible. We can, by our own endeavors, create our needs and meet our needs and rise ever more to more perfectible situations. And morals were drawn from nature. That is, the deists tended to believe that there was such a thing as God having been revealed in a sort of naturalistic way in creation, and that we could look at natural, quote, natural revelation and derive morals and ethics from nature itself.
Did they, in their writings, did they claim themselves to be deists?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Thomas Jefferson created his own Bible. Remember that he cut all the things he didn't like out of the Bible?
Sometimes I wonder, Christianity would, I mean, sometimes I feel like it's like, okay, look, you know, if you're worried about justification, you know, it's, you know, 2,000 or some years, Christ and the cross, and then in the future you have hope and this glory, but in between, you just kind of, God's not really, I mean, he's involved, he's, you know, given us his spirit, but it's kind of like, I mean, I can't really expect God to come out of nowhere because I ask him to and change. There is kind of an ultimate clockwork set, in a sense. It's kind of the feeling I get sometimes. Just, he knows where it's going. And
yeah.
Do you understand what my question is?
Yeah. Does that, is that, why does that notion?
Because it just feels like that isn't very personal. I mean, I don't really, sometimes I like, well, I don't really trust you because you're just going to do whatever you want anyway. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Well, all of us, I think, fall prey to that. I think it's too narrow to think about God and what's going on in history in such sort of cold, deterministic terms. If I look at Jesus, for example, I mean, I think we need to go back to Jesus when we have those kinds of temptations and kind of get all wired up about how God's writing this all up. Go back and look at how Jesus responded to people, tragedy, death. I guess what you're saying, though, is that there were miracles going on. God was interacting in some special kind of way. I think even there sometimes, although I'm not a really good one to speak to this, because I haven't done a lot of thinking about it, and I'm probably not capable of it, but C.S. Lewis, it's my understanding that C.S. Lewis did some writing along these lines, and maybe some of you are more familiar with this than I am, where he put the case that when we think about the miraculous, we need to think of it on a continuum, that there's a sense in which what we normally think of as miraculous is really just one step beyond what God is already doing to sustain everything that's happening. He's decided for a particular reason to do something unusual. Jesus called them signs. They were very purposed, aimed at a particular, lending concrete credibility and evidence to the message that Jesus brought, or the message of the prophets, which was a message that had to do with righteousness, judgment, and the mercy of God. So it was always the heart and soul of the message that God was bringing to the people, to his people, had to do with those things. And the miraculous, where we might tend to look at those things and say, wow, God's alive, you know, that happened. That wasn't his point at all in and of itself. Yeah, there, that was part of it. But the main point he was trying to make is, listen to this dude over here, or listen to this prophetess, or whatever the situation was. Take care, this is a servant that I'm endorsing. And listen to their message. So it wasn't the the wow of the sign itself that was significant. It was that the sign authenticated that this particular message was from God. So, and again, I think it's really helpful that Jesus lived a very human life and he was God. I like to think about Jesus and look at his response to the same tragedies and difficulties that I face, because he wept over things that I weep over. And that tells me something about the nature of God in this reality that I'm living in.
I had a real similar discussion with you just having here recently with someone, and we concluded that this, what you've said, specific signs, miracles, as we would identify them, are just highlights of a continuing one. Continuing miracle being that man hasn't destroyed himself. If we're really created in his, God has instilled in us in the creation, at least collectively, there's enough of a sense of what the right thing is to do that we haven't destroyed ourselves yet. We're still existing on the face of this earth. And that's the miracle in itself.
There is some, yeah.
Yes. Also, when God created the universe, that was a miraculous act. And so it's an inherent part of nature. It's part of the nature of nature.
Yeah.
For miracles to happen.
Yeah. I think that's part of what Lewis argued as sort of a foundational issue. I know Jack has done some thinking about the nature and place of miracles and how we think about that stuff. I can't recall right now, but it's pretty good stuff. You might ask him if you're interested. But let me move on here. The naturalist, you notice there's a stepping away. Deism is sort of a neutered Christian theism. It's just sort of one step away. It maintains a theism of sorts, but it really gets rid of all the significant issues of salvation, morality, God interacts with his creation, etc. Naturalism is the next. There is no God. The universe is constructed of, in other words, matter has always existed in some form or other. And that's how we answer the question of where did all this come from. It's just always been here. Man would simply be the highest animal, living dust, so to speak. Morals are constructs from man and society and culture. Death would be just the termination of biological viability. History, who knows? I suppose you'd think of it in linear terms. It's sort of going somewhere, but who knows where. Nihilism is the response to naturalism if we start looking at naturalism carefully and see that when it comes to determining if man means anything, is there any inherent meaning that can be drawn from chance, a chance configuration of atoms that came together at a certain point and spontaneously issued forth what we see in stages. The whole idea is that there isn't any way. Chance doesn't produce meaning. The best thing we can say about chance is that chance is all there is. I mean, there is no determiner. Other than, I should take that back. We can think in terms of a materialistic or material determinism, that there's a linkage between every step. Everything is an effect from a cause, and that effect affects something, creates a cause, creates an effect, sort of the Skinnerian view in psychology of determinism. What's that called? Behaviorism. That it's always a stimulus response, and that's just a chain of events, but ultimately with no meaning. Well, I don't know that they would have fit into the nihilism. I think they were certainly tended to be naturalists, and they certainly moved toward merging Eastern thought with Western thought, and they were the early babes in the New Age movement. So they would have probably floated more down in this area here in the New Consciousness.
The nihilism, it seems to me like, is just the same thing as naturalism.
Yeah, it is. It's just sort of drawing out. It's a place where, I mean, a person could take person could not be a consistent nihilist, I suppose, without seriously contemplating suicide. But some people do. So I mean, nihilism is simply pointing out, and it's someone, if you said to me, or if I asked someone, are you a nihilist, and said, yes, I'm a nihilist, I would conclude that they weren't particularly an existentialist. They were simply an inconsistent nihilist. That is, they don't think there's any meaning, any hope, any... Everything ends in absurdity. Nothing makes any sense. This might be a really bad overstatement, but it seems like a lot of music recently, the punk movement and derivatives from the punk movement, a lot of the thrash music that is out there that I'm all not that familiar with except that I had teenage kids, seems very nihilistic to me. It's a mood, it's a tone, it's an approach to life that basically is very negative and absurd and meaningless and just kind of says that's all there is, so let's just get on with it, you know. Whereas existentialism can actually turn the corner. An existentialist would say, no, yeah, you're right about the conclusion that everything is absurd, but we still have choice. We still can construct our own meaning, construct our own ethics and morality, and that's the basis upon which we can live.
So what's the difference between a naturalist perspective on that and an existentialist? Doesn't a naturalist, it says for man and society, it sounds like man and society are making their own moral choices, and so is the existentialist.
Yeah.
Like they're just saying that each individual man makes his own choice.
Yeah. I guess at this point maybe I should say, make this statement, and I should have said it earlier. These little categories that Sire has put together and that I've listed on this little sheet of paper are just intended to be working categories. It's not that they don't overlap or you don't find them sort of, you know, piecemeal with other things here and there, depending on what who the individual is and what they believe. I mean, you could find a kind of hodgepodge of different worldview elements in somebody's worldview that they try to put together. It would be very inconsistent, kind of incoherent, but they could say that's what I believe. So, well, it could be. On the one hand, it seems mindless in the sense that a person could decide to be mindful is silly. Why do you want to do that? The mind is useless. The mind doesn't take you anywhere. Yeah, but see, just the fact that they've concluded that means they reflected on something. They've reflected on something and they've rebounded and come to this.
I think what the existentialist has done is thought, well, you got the mind, but that reveals something. You have choice.
Yeah, I think you're getting to it there. With that.
Seems like with a nihilist, you'd have to. That'd be like a short-lived type of place that you would be in your life.
It would be very hard to continue living in a place where you were being a fairly consistent nihilist. I mean,
you could either become like an existentialist or
or unless you just don't ever think really. I mean, if you just spontaneous. Well, you just kind of do. You don't.
But it would be
that's
very.
That you base that decision, you come to that conclusion after a lot of thought. Mm-hmm. You went to like this kind of this end crap, and you just figure out the end. You know, you can't figure out an answer to it. And so basically, you decide that it's easier to not look for an answer than to try and come up with one.
Yeah, like I said, it's more of a tone or a mood or a posture that you have toward life rather than a kind of real, well-outlined worldview.
Why wouldn't there be 2 billion vastly different worldviews? You know, in the world, the existentialists, I mean, people who still believe these things.
Well, that's the big...
Any of these beyond, you know, the threshold of God, I mean, it would pretty much allow for 2 billion different worldviews to...
Yeah, and in effect, I mean, you know, if you really want to talk about the details of, you know, if we include the personal... emotional, psychological grid of every individual person. We're talking about different, you know, how many people there are in the world, that many worldviews. So we're talking in generalities here. But your point is, let me make sure I understand.
I mean, just from their perspective, I mean, there is an awful lot of consistency in the way that humans behave and you know, the fact that, you know, murder and you know, all these different
cultures is a wrong thing.
Mm-hmm. Who is they now?
I mean, you know.
People.
Yeah.
You mean to be able to explain why are there these different worldviews? Well, they might come up with a different number. And that, I mean, ultimately, to a pantheist, categorizing worldviews is a totally worthless endeavor, because everything that has appearance and differentiates everything that can be differentiated from something else is illusion. That's Maya. So to think, to make categories and to think and to postulate morals and ethics and categories and this is higher and this is lower, all that stuff would be someone who has not apprehended the real nature of reality. Well, let me do this. We only have a couple of minutes here. Take the other sheet. Let's take a look at a couple of these worldviews. What we want to do here is just look at these, and let's just try to pick out, get the reflections from all of you on what's going on. After you read it, let's just read it together so we all get done. In the beginning, God created the earth, and he looked upon it in his cosmic loneliness. And God said, "Let us make creatures out of mud, so mud can see what we have done." And God created every living creature that now moveth, and one was man. Mud, as man, alone could speak. God leaned close as man sat up, looked around and spoke. Man blinked. "What is the purpose of all this?" he asked politely. "Everything must have a purpose?" asked God. "Certainly," said man. "Then I will leave it to you to think of one for all this," said God, and he went away. Any quick responses?
Yes.
Okay, think in terms of the author of this. What's the worldview of the person who authored this? What's his point or her point? The point, it seems to me that the point is that this is a parable that explains the worldview of the author or says something about the worldview of the author. Namely, here I am, what do I make of all this? It doesn't really say much more than that. It really just says, here we are, here's all this stuff, here I am, what am I supposed to make of all this?
One thing, though, it seems like to me that man has a very high position. I mean, because with Christianity, it seems like no one ever thinks, well, man saw God.
Okay, but a naturalist could have written this as a parable. Namely, there are these myths about God and creation around. I'll just take from one of those myths and I'll create this parable, basically to tell you that I'm really confused. I don't know what to make of what's going on out here. There is one thing we can say for sure. It just occurs to me. At least we can say the author of this is questioning whether there is any authoritative word from anywhere about what the purpose of all this is. So at least the person is questioning whether there's any information.
In a sense, whether there's God.
Yeah. So we have to be careful to make, you know, to read too much into this, but I'm thinking that this is actually a quote from Jacques Curiac, The Dharma Bums. He was a very popular writer in the 60s. Let's go on to the next one. A man said to the universe, "Sir, I exist." "However," replied the universe, "the fact has not created in me a sense of obligation." What's going on? Let's unpack it a little bit.
There's no reason for its existence. I mean, in the sense that the universe doesn't really care. I mean, we have no meaning.
So do we really have, again, we have a little, kind of a little parable of, I don't even know if that's the right term to use for this, but a little scenario created to try to point at something. And what it's pointing at is the universe, although the universe has been personified here, the personification of the universe says, I have no obligation of any kind toward you, creature, you, man. End of conversation. In other words, this is a cold, uncharitable, what else can we say?
So that's saying it doesn't matter whether you exist or not.
Right.
But he knows that he does.
Right.
I think it's existentialist.
Yeah.
Okay. Very, 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 yeah.
Could be nihilist too, though.
Yeah, except for that I exist. Boy, that's existentialist if I've ever heard it.
Okay, well, let's do the last one first because it's really obvious. Everything is possible. I am God. I am Buddha. I am imperfect Ray Smith. All at the same time. I am empty space. I am all things. I have all the time in the world from life to life to do what is to do, to do what is done, to do the timeless doing of infinitely perfect within. Why cry? Why worry? Perfect mind essence in the minds of banana peels. Has anyone here done any study or taken any classes in Eastern thought, Eastern religion? Let me just mention this sort of in passing because I have to quit in a couple minutes. If you have a chance to take a class at the university or community college or whatever in Eastern thought, I really think it would be a very useful thing if you have to take a class and you need an elective or something like that. Because I think the incursion of Eastern thought into the West from the 60s on has been very powerful. It's still growing. It was very interesting to me. I don't know how many of you saw the movie Flatliners. I had to laugh. They get to the end of the movie. But get to the end of the movie, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, this guy makes a statement about karma, when there has been nothing said all the way through the whole movie about, you know, any metaphysical statements other than, is there anything beyond on the other side somewhere? Is there any kind of consciousness on the other side? And that's what they're trying to figure out by doing these experiments. And all of a sudden, this inserted into this film comes this statement by one of them, the only way he can explain the bad things that are happening is karma. Well, this was here, a high-tech, Western, scientific, rationalistic approach to life, and a movie all about that until you get, you know, three-fifths of the way through the movie, and then bang, out of nowhere, comes this statement. Well, it was just so stark to me that they didn't ask the question. The question didn't even begin to approach any kind of biblical question. It just went directly, not past go, did not collect $200. It went straight to Eastern thought. And it just was so clear that that's exactly what's on the agenda of the intelligentsia, quote unquote, today, and where people are going to go if they want to talk about spiritual things or metaphysics or one's religious beliefs or, you know, this is an in thing. Well, we've run out of time. If you have a chance and you're curious and you want to, you can read the last one for yourself. It also is very straightforward, so you shouldn't have any trouble determining where it's coming from. I hope this little excursion has been helpful to you, and I'd be glad to talk with any of you about other things if you want to make an appointment or set up a time to do that.